Hello.
From 88 MHz up to 108.
You've got this frequency. We're going to call you CKUP. You've got this frequency. 98.3. That frequency is what you're picking up when you tune that radio.
Very impressive.
You can sit on the moon and look like they pick up CKUP, clear as a bell.
Fascinating. Your analysis seems logical.
CKUT is on the air.
Hello, my guys, gals, and non-binary pals. You are listening to CKUT 90.3, and this is Voices of Montreal, Panacea, with me, Michelle. It's raining, and it's super gloomy in Montreal, today, and I miss the sun, so let's start off today with a song instead of my babbling.
Survive.
Okay. Thanks, Jeff, for that amazing start to my show. I did finally come up with a name for my show. It's called Panacea. I feel like I talked about it last month, but my memory's kind of bad. So for anyone who missed it, or if I actually didn't talk about it, and I'm just making things up, Panacea means a solution or remedy for all difficulties or diseases. So kind of like a cure-all. And I feel like I definitely talked about this. Okay, well, I'm going to say it again because I love talking about myself. I love Greek mythology. So the word Panacea was also the name of a Greek goddess of universal remedy. And she also had four sisters, and they each performed, according to Wikipedia lore, they each performed a facet of Apollo's art. So Hygieia was the goddess or personification of health, cleanliness, and sanitation. Iasso was the goddess of recuperation from illness. Aceso is the goddess of the healing process. And Aegle was the goddess of radiant good health. And I chose this name for my show because when I was really struggling with my mental health a lot, especially being like a young girl who was trying to like figure out who she was and like how she fit in this world and what she wanted to do, I had a lot of trouble because I really wanted someone to help me or explain what was going on or like have some guidance, but it was really hard for me to access like medication or healthcare, like treatment or therapy. And so what I did was I basically threw myself into research. I am kind of nerdy, so I get really sucked into topics and like dedicate myself to them for a long time. And most of them I kind of forget about and then like lose interest, but not on the topic of mental health. So I did a bunch of research and I was like, this is so important for me to know. And like it explains so many things and answers so many questions. And it helped me so much to like feel more comfortable in my own skin and be like, okay, this is actually normal. A lot of people have experienced similar things to this. This isn't just a me thing. It's my mental illness. So, I sort of took that and I ran with it and made me really passionate about mental health. And I really have a strong, strong belief that mental health literacy is like a panacea. It is a cure-all because, I mean, understanding what goes on in your brains, understanding how your brain works and how your mind works and all of these cognitive biases that we have that like, or all of these like hurtful narratives that we create for other people and for ourselves, is really, really helpful in being able to practice empathy and being empathetic towards yourself and towards other people, which, I mean, in and of itself, I took a whole class last semester about how empathy has the power for organizational, social, and personal change. And so I think, I don't know, mental health literacy is really important to me, and that's why my show is called Panacea. So back on topic. Today's segment is going to follow last month's theme of discussing neurodivergencies or like neurodivergent minds. So I'm going to continue that discussion about ADHD. And if we have time and I don't babble too much, I'm also going to talk about autism spectrum disorder. And if we don't get to that today, I will do that next month. So I'm going to talk about myself for a little bit more. I am now back from my trip, which was epic, if anyone was wondering. I did like a little, okay, it doesn't matter where I went. I went to Europe and I went to Australia, but I did get very lonely at times because I did go alone. Although I did get to see my friends a lot of the time, I did some solo trips by myself and I haven't talked like to many people. So I have a lot of talking to get out because I've been alone. I literally would take videos of myself on Snapchat and like, just like of me talking, like the most random things, and I talk and then I just delete the video because like, who am I sending them to? No one really cares. And so I talk and I delete the video and then I make another video and I talk, and it was like, it makes it seem a little bit more acceptable and like less, a little bit more sane if I'm talking to a video than if I was just sitting, talking to myself on my walks. So yes. Anyways, I did get very lonely. Also because little things would go wrong for me. That word negligible, I don't know why I use that big word, that were like whatever on their own, they weren't that big of a deal. But then obviously when things start to build up, it becomes a lot harder to carry all of them at once. And since I was alone, I didn't really have anyone to share those frustrations with me. So it was kind of hard because I was like, well, I just walked 20 minutes to go get this rum cake from the store that said it was closing at 10 p.m., but it closed actually at 9:30 p.m. And so I showed up and I was really frustrated because the things that I was doing during the day were really exhausting. And so like I walked home and I cried, and then I got myself a $7 tiramisu flavored gelato, which was a bit absurd. But you know, like things like that, it's not like, I don't know, if it didn't feel like things that I could like call up my friends to rant about because it was so small. So it would have been nice to have someone to share it with. This trip, I also stopped taking my Vyvanse, which, disclaimer, I am not a healthcare professional, nor am I a mental health clinician. So obviously all of my anecdotes and advice that I give here, please take it with a grain of salt. You know yourself better than I know you, obviously. And so please take what applies for you and what works for you. But this is not any medical professional advice, and do not do what I do if you don't want to. So I stopped taking my Vyvanse. So if anyone is currently prescribed medication, do not stop taking your medication. But it definitely made things more interesting for sure, because the way that my medication shows up in my life has been, I mean, there's obviously some negative side effects that have really affected me, but it's also been very positive for the way that I'm able to better manage my emotions, better, like not be as overstimulated, etc. So, yes, I don't know actually why I went on that entire rant. I kind of went off topic again. So me being full of like juxtapositions and oxymorons, I have great semantic memory, but terrible episodic memory. And so I can't really remember anything that I've done or said ever. So I have really bad memory and stuff like that. But then for things that I see written down, or like when I'm memorizing for like exams and stuff, my memory is great. So I don't know. What do you call it? Get one, lose the other. I don't know the word for it. So I can't remember if I brought this up last month, but I wanted to start our continuation of ADHD by talking about some things that I've been seeing on social media regarding ADHD. Obviously, ADHD can be really hard to diagnose sometimes because the symptom presentation, fancy word, which is basically like the symptoms that you have, or that affects you, or if you're living with ADHD, it can vary a lot from person to person. So someone living with ADHD, like no two people living with ADHD are going to look exactly the same, because there are so many different facets that can play in and affect our daily lives. And a lot of the things that people living with ADHD struggle with are also things that people without ADHD can struggle with as well. So like a little bit of indecisiveness, like trouble making decisions, trouble initiating tasks. Like we all experience that at some level at some point in our lives. However, it's just, a lot, as with a lot of mental illnesses, like when it gets to a point that it's interfering with your, with the way that you live your life or with your work or your school, that's when it becomes sort of flagged a little bit. And also because ADHD is something, and that has to do with the differences in the way that the brain develops. So a neurotypical brain looks very different from a neurodivergent brain. And that's also really important to remember, that there are significant structural, biological differences between people living with ADHD and without ADHD. So I see many TikToks and Instagrams and posts and videos that talk about ADHD. And they always say like, you're so ADHD if you do this, or like, put a finger down if you have this, but I'm not going to tell you what it is at the end. And then it's like, you have ADHD. Or I saw this post because I follow a lot of mental health creators on Instagram. And so I saw a post that says, this is such an ADHD couch. And I was like, yeah, that's like a pretty fun couch. Like it's pretty silly, whatever. But a couch doesn't like encapsulate the experience of ADHD. And so there's so many things like that provide misinformation or just like throw noise to the conversation surrounding ADHD that makes it really hard for people who actually genuinely want to search out something and get help and learn more about ADHD. It makes it really hard for them to know what is actually just noise in media, in the media, and what is actually true, factual, grounded information. And so this can also lead to a lot of misconceptions about ADHD, and like can lead to people living with ADHD feeling underrepresented or misunderstood because their peers or their friends or their teachers around them only interact with media that misrepresents people living with ADHD, being like, you're so ADHD if you're like a little bit quirky. Like, no, yes, everyone can be quirky, but that's not a defining factor of ADHD and shouldn't be included in that umbrella of terms. And so I actually was reading this article from this magazine, this website called Attitude Mag, which I think is so awesome. Attitude as in like, but it's spelled ADD-itude because ADHD, yeah. And this is a really helpful website. I will link it like in the comments or something when I post my archive, but this is a really helpful website for explaining some things about ADHD and learning more about how to support your friends or your children living with ADHD. And so researchers evaluated the 100 most popular TikTok videos about ADHD, and only 11 out of 100 of those videos were created by credentialed healthcare providers, and none of them were uploaded by corporations, health organizations, and for-profit and nonprofit entities. And so 27% of those videos were classified as personal experience. So when I talk about, you know, my personal experiences living with ADHD, this is not to be used as some sort of diagnostic classification, but when I share, it's obviously like to help someone out there feel less alone and like be like, hey, actually I'm experiencing something like this too. And it's okay to talk about it because I'm talking about it openly on the radio, which is a bit terrifying. And 52% of those videos were classified as misleading. So there's a lack in scientific evidence, or people are just saying things and basing them off of common stereotypes. And so only 21% of those videos were classified as useful. This meaning they contain scientifically correct information about ADHD regarding their symptoms, diagnosis, or treatments. And so non-healthcare providers uploaded most of the inaccurate videos. And none of these misleading videos sort of urged or recommended viewers to like seek out medical, psychiatric, or some sort of clinician help before attributing these symptoms to ADHD. And so there is a lot of misinformation in the like world of social media, as you know, like if you search up something, you can find evidence for anything online. And so I just want to remind you all out there to be conscious consumers of media, because there are many things that can give off a poor representation of what a neurodivergent mind or what sort of even living with mental illness is like. And so just remember where you get your information from. The information presented to you isn't always accurate, and it's important to check your sources. I know that sounds super nerdy and super teacher of me, but it's really important if we want to work to reduce stigma surrounding the conversation about neurodivergent minds or about mental health and mental illness. So we're going to switch gears a little bit after this song, and we're going to talk about hopefully three different facets of ADHD. So we're going to talk about sensory overload, rejection sensitivity, dysphoria, and object impermanence. And so this is one of my fave songs right now. It's always been my fave song, but this is Stay With Me by Lorraine Ellison.
Oh, did you run to
That's one of the songs that I always wish was longer because I listened to that on repeat. One time I listened to a song 52 times in a row by accident because I just put it on and then I was doing something. I think I was like cleaning my bathtub. And so I listened to the song 52 times in one day and then I ended up being in like the top 5.5% of listeners on Spotify, which is pretty cray. But anyway, Spotify gang, love that. Okay, so we're going to talk about sensory overload, which can make relatively harmless and really simple situations really draining and anxiety-provoking. And so I experience this a lot when I go to the grocery store. Whenever I go grocery shopping, I get really overstimulated. And I love touching things. Like, I love the feel of things in my hands. So I like going around and touching, like, all the little, like, packets and, like, stuff because it just is satisfying to me, but it's also really distracting and really hard for me to stay on task. And sometimes I just shut down and need to be guided like a toddler in the grocery store, which is totally okay. Some days my brain just doesn't have the capacity for that right now, and that's totally fine. Or I can spend hours in the grocery store, and because there's so many options, like even if I have a list, I'm like, oh my God, like which one of these 99 cent pasta tomato sauce cans should I choose? Like, should I choose this big one? Or is like, this one's red, so it's a little bit, you know? And this isn't exactly sensory overload, but it's just a lot of overwhelming things happening at once because there's so many options that like, it's really hard for my brain to filter out all of that noise in my environment and focus on what's actually important, which is what's on my grocery list. And even when I have my list, I'm like, tomatoes. I'm like, okay, there's literally 5 different kinds of tomatoes. I'm going to go over and squish every one to see the ripeness because I like my tomatoes kind of like firm. So there's a lot that goes on in my brain. So usually I spend like my shopping trip will take like 3 hours from like leaving the door to coming back in the door and then unloading all my things because I also like to give my roommates, I feel like I talk really fast. I also like to give my roommates hauls of my groceries because it's really fun. But, I usually only give it to Kara, but sometimes when everyone's home, we do a big grocery haul and it's really important. So I also find myself getting really frustrated with loud noises and overlapping noises and things like I really can't park well when I'm listening to music. Not that my hearing has anything to do with my sight, but it's just like I can't focus on what I'm looking at and on the movements and, you know, fitting into the spot if I'm also, there's also like audio input going into my ears. And I also can't concentrate when I study with music. If I'm reading words and I'm looking at something or I'm typing something or I'm doing anything that involves like taking in words, I cannot listen to music with words because it just like jumbles up in my brain. I can't have audio going into my ear and then also like words coming into my eyes. You know what I mean? And so that gets really overwhelming for me. So I need to work in silence. So I don't usually listen to music, but when I do, I listen to classical music, which doesn't have words, but sometimes I can find it too distracting because some of my favorite songs are classical songs. And so I get too into it. I blame Vivaldi. Sorry. And sometimes, interestingly, I get really angry. So I often don't express that anger. It's sort of like an internal, like grunt frustration. But I get really frustrated when like someone's trying to talk to me, but someone else is trying to talk to me and like there's overlapping voices because I can't filter out just one voice. And sometimes I'm really good at multitasking like that, but it gets really overwhelming for me that I'm like, I don't really know what to do. So I externalize those emotions and I feel anger and I get really angry and sometimes I can snap. I've never done that, only like at my siblings because, you know, sibling love. And so I snap at them a lot because it's too hard for me and my brain to handle like so many things coming in at once. Cause then I get really overwhelmed and then I either shut down and internalize or I externalize with some like, don't do that, which also isn't awesome. And this is true, of people of all ages living with ADHD. So a lot of people, think that ADHD sort of you grow out of it into adulthood, and a lot of people do. So as our brains continue developing, a lot of people can sort of grow out, not that ADHD is something you always grow out of, but you know, our brains are developing, they're very plastic, they're very easily which is awesome. And so not everyone goes on to have ADHD in adulthood if they did have it in childhood. But there are people living with ADHD who are adults and who still struggle with the same things. And these little things may seem irrational or childish. And so they can easily get shrugged off or laughed off or not taken seriously. Or people living with ADHD who have these issues might sort of self-stigmatize and not want to express that something's bothering them or that they're feeling really overstimulated and overwhelmed. And then feel like they're not safe enough to fully be able to be themselves and express themselves because, you know, it's not as commonly talked about. And sort of on the flip side, this can also lead to shutting down. So sometimes I shut down and I sort of need to like lay in my bed in a circle, like just get relaxed and like come back to equilibrium a bit. And so a lot of the times this sort of shutting down, especially when you're overstimulated in public places, or if you're with your friends and you're in a loud, large crowd or something like that, shutting down can often be taken as something like that's rude or an insult, even though you're not trying to be, and that's not your intention at all, but people don't know what's going on in your minds. And so it can be interpreted as like, oh, Michelle is so rude because like she's not talking and she just sort of left the situation. But when in reality, I'm like, I'm really overwhelmed right now and I can't really understand what's happening. And so I need to remove myself from the situation before I shut down in the middle of this crowd or I get frustrated in the middle of this crowd. Both are things which I don't want and also provoke my anxiety. And so sometimes it's really hard for me to distinguish between my ADHD and anxiety. I feel like I've definitely talked about this before, but like when sensory overload happens, I'm not sure if it's because I'm just like anxious being in a big crowd around a lot of people or if I'm anxious, like, yeah, just like being out, because I'm getting a lot more anxious about that recently, which is okay. It's something I'm working on. It comes in waves. You know, there's going to be times where my anxiousness is really under my control and like I can really get on top of it. And there's sometimes where it's not. And that's the way it is. I'm just going to keep doing what works for me, you know? So usually it's both. Usually it's both my ADHD and my anxiety that's causing me to feel like not 100% or not myself in certain situations. But when I can't tell the difference and my coping strategies aren't working, like because I have a lot of coping strategies that I use to deal when my triggers for anxiety get activated, I don't know how I cope. And so I get really overwhelmed because I'm feeling like my emotions are in control and not me being in control of my emotions. So the balance of the scales gets tipped a little, and then I'm sort of in this sort of like purgatory, motionless state where I'm, it feels like I'm floating through space because my brain is overwhelmed and I can't do anything in that moment to make myself feel better. So jumping to a little sidebar here, sorry that I'm all over the place today. Maybe I should have taken my Vyvanse. But I was doing some reflection recently. I've become a reader. And I feel like that's made me more zen, even though I think I'm just lying to myself. I've been reading Percy Jackson. So as a grown woman, Percy Jackson is something I read in grade 5. But to get your intrinsic motivation back into reading and other things, you have to do something that's fun. And Percy Jackson is fun. I don't want to like jump into like Charles Dickens, like, I don't know. That's not even like, I don't know. I actually don't read that much. So I don't even know like a hard like book that you could read is, but think of one. So I'm reading Percy Jackson. I don't know where I was going with that, but I was doing some reflection recently and I realized that there is, at least from my perspective, obviously this may be different for other people, there is very little or very hard to access or like not really widely known about quote unquote therapy or help for people with ADHD. Like when I'm talking to my therapist, we obviously discuss helpful coping mechanisms to sort of regulate my anxiety, like name my anxious thoughts for what they are and sort of break them down. And I remember I used to have a debate. We used to stage a debate where you had this like idea or thought that was untrue. So for me, that was, I don't deserve to be loved. And I put that in the middle, and then me and, the social worker who was at my high school, we would look at that thought and then we'd come up with the pro side and the nay side, and we'd debate it and be like, what makes this statement true in your life? What evidence do you have and what evidence do you have that makes it not true? And so, you know, helpful strategies and like behavioral tips, like breathing tips, have been really helpful for me to get out of my head a little bit when I'm feeling super anxious, and just to work through my anxious thoughts and be like, okay, that was an anxious thought. I'm going to let that happen. I'm not going to reject it. I'm not going to stop it from happening. I'm just going to know that this is an anxious thought and it's not true. But I didn't really find that I had the same sort of support in terms of my ADHD, like specifically directed towards ADHD, which is, I feel like, something that's a little bit of a gap in the market. And I'm pretty sure there's a market in the gaps. So maybe I'll capitalize on that in the future. But yeah, so that's something that I've recently realized. And I think that's something that's really important to be talked about, because a lot of people live with ADHD. And a lot of the times, medication is sort of the one sort of treatment that works the best. But I think that medication works best hand in hand with like some sort of reflective self work, and things like that. So I think I'm going to do, another, if I have time, maybe at the end, or I'll sneak it into next month's segment about, autism spectrum disorder. I'll talk a little bit about some helpful coping mechanisms that I've found have helped me manage, my ADHD a little bit better. But one thing that I do that's really helpful and maybe a little bit absurd is that I make my grocery list in order of the layout of the store. And so every time I go to Metro, I have my grocery list and I check off the things that I need, but it's in the list. The list is in the order of the layout of the store. So as I walk through Metro, everything that's on my list is already on the way. So I don't have to go out of my way or go back to get other things because I weave my way through, which I find has been really helpful in helping me stay on task. And it's also kind of fun. It's fun for me. So maybe try that, see if it works. Don't try it, whatever. That's what I do. And it's super helpful. But a lot of my understanding and learning has come simply from doing research on the topic and learning about how the brain and neurotransmitter and sensory systems work through not only my own research, but also because of classes I've taken. And so it's been really helpful just learning like the way that a neurotypical brain would process information or, you know, regulate emotions, or make decisions, and then learning about neurotransmitters that are important for helping the brain function and perform tasks, and then learning about the neurodivergent brain and how it's different from a neurotypical brain, because that helps me understand a lot more about why I am the way I am, which is pretty cool, learning about myself. But that is a little bit dense, so I think I'm also going to do a separate segment about the neuroscience and biology behind ADHD. So if you're sort of into the sciencey and biology side of neurodivergent brains and mental illness, I will definitely do that. But it just requires a bit more research, and I obviously want to give you guys the facts and fun stuff, but also in a really like chewable way. So I will do that better later. So I will also link some helpful sources and creators that I found on social media that have broken down ADHD in simple, understandable layman terms, because sometimes I feel like I talk really fast. Maybe I don't make sense, but I think I'm pretty awesome. So I think I've been talking too much. I'm going to play Naive by The Kooks.
Seeing it is your fault, although you could have done more. Oh, you're so naive, yes, so how could this be done with such a smiling sweetheart? Oh, and your sweet and pretty face is such an ugly one, something so beautiful. Oh, that every time I look inside, I know she knows that I'm not fond of asking. True or false it may be, or she's still out to get me. And I know she knows that I'm not fond of asking. True or false it may be, she's still out to get me. I may say it was your fault, because I know you could have done more.
Okay, so just to sum up sensory overload, some helpful things that might be helpful if, well, obviously some helpful things that might be helpful, some things that might be helpful if you know that you're going to be in a situation that's more likely to evoke some sort of sensory overload for you. It may be helpful to identify like calming techniques that help you either reduce the effects of feeling overwhelmed or avoid them altogether. And so mindfulness and self-talk strategies are helpful to just sort of calm your limbic system and help you start off at a better baseline, so that once, if you do sort of get overstimulated, it might not sort of trigger that threshold of you feeling like you need to leave or, you know, shut down. As well, if you have to go somewhere, if you don't really have a choice and it's not something that you can avoid, it might be helpful, you know, to take steps to sort of pre-plan ahead and things like, I don't know, I always bring my headphones everywhere I go. I bring, and they have noise canceling in them, which is really nice if I need to like shut off everything around me and just listen to some music, get out of my head for a second. I don't know, bringing like a book to read is also really helpful if I just need to like go to a corner and read a book or go on the subway and read a book. Like that sort of helps me take, helps dull the noise behind me, which I think has been really helpful. And so I want to switch the gears a little bit. I feel like I didn't talk for so long today. Jeez. I want to talk a bit about rejection sensitivity. And so, I mean, we all sort of have a fear of rejection. Rejection is scary. And a lot of the times when we get rejected, we feel like it's something that reflects on our character. It's something that means that there's a flaw within us that makes us be rejected. And there's something wrong inherently with you or something about you that's causing this rejection. But that's not true. Most of the time, rejection is not personal, but it's really hard not to feel that way. And so rejection isn't really something you want to experience. However, rejection sensitive dysphoria is different. It's when you experience severe emotional pain because of a failure or feeling rejected. And this is linked with ADHD. And it's not that people living with ADHD are like scaredy cats or like we should walk on eggshells around them or that they can't handle rejection. It's also, you shouldn't be thinking that people living with ADHD are using their rejection sensitivity as an excuse to get out of something or to avoid rejection or to like get the other person to not reject them. And simply that the emotional response of rejection hurts people living with ADHD much more than it does for people without the condition. So no one likes to be rejected, criticized, or failed. But for people who have rejection sensitive dysphoria or RSD, they're much more severe than for people who are neurotypical. And this difference in brain structure between neurotypical and neurodivergent brains may be one of the reasons why people with ADHD are more likely to experience RSD. And so this sort of makes sense given that, you know, we've sort of talked about how people with ADHD have more trouble regulating their emotions. However, we have to make a distinction between just simply rejection sensitivity and rejection sensitive dysphoria. And so emotional dysregulation happens when your brain can't properly regulate signals related to your emotions. And so you get a lot of input from your senses and from your memories and from your emotions. And your brain is responsible for sorting through all that noise to come up with a response. So how do I respond to this emotion? How do I respond to this like visual input that's coming to me? Or like something's hot on my arm. How do I respond? I'm going to move it away. Right? And your brain matures and it learns to regulate these signals and solidifies these sort of neural pathways that you have. However, when something about your brain is fundamentally different or you're lacking certain structures or neurotransmitters that help you create these neural pathways, the radio is jammed and you can't turn the volume down. And so you have all of this noise and all of this input coming. very hopeless, because once you react in this way, it's obviously not because you're angry at the actual person themselves or you're angry at the situation, but it's the way that your emotional dysregulation for people living with ADHD and all of these neurodivergent systems working in your brain that make you respond in such a way, which from an outside perspective can make you look really like, I don't know, drama queen or like insensitive or rude, because, you know, your emotional reaction is obviously, it seems like it's not like molehill out of an ant hole sort of thing. And so without understanding where people living with ADHD or people who have RSD, where they come from and how their brains work and function and the way that they respond to things, it can be really easy to slip into this mindset of viewing them in a negative light. And that sort of, and negative stereotypes are really, really hard to get rid of. It takes a lot of opposing positive evidence to make someone change their beliefs. And so these sort of things can be really damaging, which is why I'm telling you guys about them. So because we know that the brain of someone with ADHD doesn't regulate our internal, the inputs that we get from all of our emotions and memory, it's not regulated the same way. And so the way our brain communicates with the rest of our body and with other areas of our brain is very different. And there's less of a filter on our brain activity. And there's also, we lack the neurotransmitters that prevent us from making impulsive decisions. So this is why a lot of impulsive emotional outbursts are really common. And so we have a lot of people, when I say we, I mean people living with ADHD, although this is not exclusive to everyone living with ADHD. Some people may experience this and some people may not. But a lot of people with ADHD have trouble processing information from their senses, which is also why you feel this sensory overload. So this is sort of all connected, the sensory overload and rejection sensitivity. And so because the brain, our brains have more trouble regulating pain-like activity because of all of these like contrasting and overlapping signals in our brain, it can explain why rejection is much more troubling and painful to someone with rejection sensitive dysphoria and rejection sensitive dysphoria is often a trait of someone who has ADHD as well. And so RSD isn't an officially recognized medical condition. There's also very limited scientific research available on this topic, as with other facets of ADHD, which is something that I'm also really passionate about looking into. And so because of this, because it's not as well known, a lot of healthcare providers and mental health clinicians may not know much about it or have a lot of experience with it, which can make the experience of living with ADHD one that is really isolating. And it may result in misdiagnosis, which can also just lead to a lot of more difficulties and confusion surrounding what's actually going on. And so RSD makes adults with ADHD anticipate rejection. And it also causes us to see rejection from ambiguous situations where rejection probably wasn't even a possibility in the first place, which makes it very easy for people to want to avoid situations with rejection, especially if you're feeling such a strong emotional scar from your previous experience of rejection. And this can lead to you wanting to be avoidant of all social situations or all situations where you could experience some sort of rejection. And this can be misdiagnosed as social phobia, which is an anticipatory fear, anticipatory anxiety that you will be embarrassed or humiliate yourself in public or be scrutinized harshly by people in public. And so it causes you to avoid situations like that. And there are two ways that people with ADHD generally cope with this huge emotional elephant. And I've taken this from, again, an article from Attitude Mag, which I will also link below like the comment section on the webpage. But people with ADHD who also experience rejection sensitive dysphoria will become people pleasers. And so they will want to avoid rejection in any way. And so they will overcompensate, sacrifice their needs for others, and do anything that they can do to make another person like them because they don't want to be rejected by them, because they don't want to feel this sort of emotional pain. Or people can stop trying. And so if there's a slight possibility that someone might try something new and fail or embarrass themselves in front of someone else, or if there's a chance to reach out to someone new or like connect with someone new, a lot of times these opportunities will get passed up, which, because it is too painful or too risky, from the person's perspective. And so really awesome, vibrant, fun, like outgoing people avoid activities that are too anxiety provoking and end up giving up things like, you know, like standing up for themselves at work or applying for a job or a promotion or speaking up in public or, meeting new friends or dating or any, like there's so many opportunities that we, can pass off because of this fear of rejection. And so oftentimes your friend may, like your friend living with ADHD who you know has RSD isn't trying to be standoffish or flaky or rude. They're just feeling a little bit overwhelmed because fundamentally at the core of it, their brain does not function in the same way that a neurotypical brain does. And because this is such an invisible, all mental illnesses and neurodivergent diseases for the most part are invisible diseases, it can be hard to put any sort of legitimacy or truth to them. Because I'm not going to go like dig around your brain. I'm not Miss Frizzle. This isn't the magic school bus. But it's also important to remember that, you know, takeaways are what you consume on media is never really an accurate representation of someone's experience, because it may just be there's no scientific evidence backing up what someone's saying, or they're speaking from personal experience, which is not applicable, nor is it transferable to any other person's experience of living with mental illness or ADHD or autism spectrum disorder or anything. And so it's important to fact check your sources, do your own research, and find out what actually comes from healthcare professionals and what comes from people who live with ADHD. It's also important to recognize that none of these things that may seem rude or standoffish are always like personal hits to your character or someone's trying to like be rude, because we most of the time we aren't trying to be rude. There's just a lot going on in the brain and the world is a hard place to be in. And there's so many things happening that I think it's important that we all stop, take a breath and try and put ourselves in someone else's shoes. And this is basically what my show tries to do, tries to give you the perspective of someone else's shoes so that we can all have a little bit of empathy and be closer and feel closer to the people around us, even if we don't know who they are, because we know that we all experience very similar things. And so to end off my show today, I'm going to play Midnight Train to Georgia, which did play a little bit at the beginning, but it's okay. Enjoy.
So he's leaving the life he's come to know. Ooh.
He said he's going.
He said he's going back to find.
Going back to find.
Ooh, 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 what's left of his world? The world he left behind. Not so long.
Sorry, my phone fell. My bad.
Yeah. Said he's going back.
Going back to
a simpler place and time.
That right.
Oh, yes, he is.
Right by his side.
Now I'll be with him.
I know you will.
On that midnight train to Georgia.
Even on that midnight train to Georgia.
Hey, hey, hey.
Whoa, whoa.
I'd better rather live in his world than live without him in mine.
World is his and hers alone.
He kept dreaming, ooh, that someday he'd be a star,
a superstar, but he didn't get far.
But he so found out the hard way that dreams don't always come true.
Thank you for joining me for some fun tunes and vulnerable conversations, and I will see you again next month on the last Thursday.
Thanks to everyone who donated to CKUT's annual funding drive. Your generosity truly helps keep our engines burning. It's never too late to donate. You can do so by calling 514-907-9424 or going to ckut.ca and hit the green Make a Pledge button at the top. All paid entries will be entered into a grand prize draw. You can pay your pledge and pick up your gift weekdays between 11 to 6 p.m. or by appointments. Call 514-907-9424. Thank you.
Not what I got.